I'm connecting to the internet.
Internet.
Networking software.
World Wide Web.
The web. Computer today.
Computer.
NetSurfer Pro.
Welcome to NetSurfer Pro, a whirlwind ride through the World Wide Web. I am, of course, Matt Craig, your primary tour guide, and with me is...
Galen Wilson, your tertiary tour guide. Don't ask what happened to the secondary tour guide. They got lost. You know, Matt, I've been having a good day.
That's good. Me too.
Yeah. I went on a ride in my Volkswagen GTI Roadster Vision Gran Turismo to go to the movie theater to see the Grand Budapest Hotel. And then I took, you know, a little trip up to Target, Canada, playing some Hearthstone Heroes of Warcraft on my phone, on my, of course, Apple iPhone 6 Plus. And, you know, then I got back home to watch some Warehouse 13 on my Sony KD65X9005B. Maybe even play a little bit of Dark Souls 2, which is Game of the Year, by the way, before going outside to film the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge. Because today happens to be Throwback Thursday, and we are throwing back all the way to 2014.
I was getting really worried. I thought you had just, like, woken up from a coma or something.
Oh, don't worry. I've been in a coma for at least 20 years, and all 20 of them have been 2020.
That's true.
You want to know why it's a Throwback Thursday specifically to 2014? Three things.
I was going to say because we're stuck in a existential crisis in which our only way of going outside is to do so mentally. But go on.
You aren't incorrect, but there's three specific things. Number one, the best rhythm game on the market is made by Harmonix.
Oh, that's true.
Yes, Fuser looks really, really good. I actually would quite like to do it.
It is.
Number two, Anita Sarkeesian is in the news because gamers are mad at her.
Again?
Yeah.
How unfortunate.
And number three, the series we're going to be talking about today, the miniseries, was actually made in 2014.
Isn't that interesting? That's like 6 years ago. Actually, that's exactly 6 years ago.
Yeah. It'll soon be seven, actually, because it's, as we're recording this, it is November 19th of 2020.
Right. And what better for a sort of between fall and winter time period, though it's really hot outside right now, is Over the Garden Wall.
Yes. Oh, this is a series that oozes fall from its pores.
It also pours because there's a lot of rain in it. It's a joke.
Oh, right. All right. I've heard of it before.
So Over the Garden Wall was a miniseries that ran on Cartoon Network in 2014. It was created by Patrick McHale and Katie Krentz. And of course it has, you know, many other talented people working on it.
Yes, yes. It was developed as a miniseries, 10 episodes, basically from the get-go. There were planned to be more episodes, but they were trimmed down for time and such. And so it's really just the whole package is only 2 hours, barely.
Right. When we say 10 episodes, this is American cartoon episodes, which are like 15 minutes long, maybe less.
Well, 15 minutes with ad breaks, they're 11 minutes standard, which I believe every episode is 11 minutes in this specific series.
So yeah, that's just under 2 hours if you do the math, which I did.
Hang on. Yeah, math checks out.
Okay,
just had
cool.
to do it too.
Good, just making sure. I don't want to be too presumptuous.
Of course.
So, Over the Garden Wall, just kind of to sum it up, It's a journey through a mysterious woods known as the Unknown, where we follow Wirt and his little brother Greg as they try to make their way back home while running away from some mystical beast known just as the Beast.
Along the way, they meet up with a talking bird named Beatrice in the first episode, which I believe Beatrice is with them throughout the entire series, more or less. And they meet, you know, multiple recurring characters and a lot of characters that are just one-offs. primarily the more recurring characters are the woodsman, who is chopping down Edelwood to light and or keep alight a lantern.
There's the frog, which is given many names throughout the series.
Yes. The frog that Greg specifically has as a pet, kind of. Who talks also in one episode. Only one episode, unfortunately.
Well, three episodes if you want to be specific, but yeah.
That's true.
And then, yeah, there's many other side characters that appear. Some of them stick throughout episodes like Fred the Horse. He kind of exists in two episodes, but for the most part, they just kind of are one-offs. The series is very, like, I don't want to say an anthology series, because it does have an overarching story, but in the main, like, episode content, it's very much like, you know, pit stops on a road trip.
Yes.
You know, each episode kind of is its own location with its own people, with their own problems, and somehow Wirt and Greg make their way out of it alive.
Yeah. And, I do want to stop real quickly before we get too into it, and just sort of say that Net Surfer Pro is obviously an aggregate of things popular on the net, a whirlwind tour through the World Wide Web. And it's kind of interesting how Over the Garden Wall specifically ties to this, because Over the Garden Wall is specifically popular kind of only really in an online setting. It's one of those things like, oh gosh, I'm trying to make a comparison, but I kind of can't.
It's sort of a cult hit, you know? Like,
yeah,
it's 10 episodes long. It's very short, especially compared to a lot of other series it's compared to and paired with. You know, that ran for like multiple seasons. But it is also like super highly regarded, but mainly among like the crowd of people that use like message boards.
Yeah, it's a series that now kind of exists mostly just for like cult appeal. So to think about it from a business standpoint, it's a miniseries of 10 episodes, and they aired on Cartoon Network originally. Yeah, Cartoon Network. And they basically just aired for 5 straight days, 2 episodes to a day, and then just that's really it. Like, after that, it's just, you know, rerunning them and DVD release. The actual sort of television profits are just ads from playing the episodes, DVD releases, merch, which there really isn't much, from my understanding. So, like, the actual profits of it in a show sense is low. But the fact that it is a 10-episode miniseries that's very easy to just kind of watch like a movie means that it's really good for streaming services, which I would say, like, I don't want to say it's ahead of its time. I think it's more like of its time, because 2014 is kind of around when, like, streaming services were starting to basically dominate the market. They hadn't gotten, they weren't completely above everything yet, but they were sort of obviously the way of the future.
Yeah.
And so
it's like, it's very appropriate for its time, I would say. It's one of the earlier maybe examples of like a bingeable show, but it also just happens to be very good for that purpose. Like, I actually just rewatched the whole thing last night.
Yeah, I pretty much, like, in the couple of hours up to this point, I rewatched it just dotting around from episode to episode as I saw fit. Right.
So I think we should probably just go over kind of the episodes, because with each one having their own, like, location and characters and stuff, each one has its own themes as well. There are obviously overarching sort of tones and themes and whatnot. It is very autumnal, like we said. There's lots of browns and oranges and lots of fallen leaves. In some episodes, definitely play into that more. And eventually, towards the end of the series, it gets very wintry as well. Which is why it feels perfect for November. October.
Yeah, it's on the perfect cusp right now between fall right now and winter soon. Although, currently, it feels more like spring because it's nice outside.
Yeah.
Which it shouldn't be. but... So, yeah, to start off, I suppose, with just episode one, The Old Gristmill, it's the introduction. I attempted to watch the series with creator commentary on. I honestly could not. It was very dry. Nothing against either of the creators on it. It just sort of, I was looking for a lot of like specifics, and it was just kind of a lot of like, talking about kind of the process of making things as a whole. So I don't have much in the way of like from Word of God. But this is, I do know that this was made actually later in production, the first episode. They specifically kind of like focused on the episodes as their own individual stories first, and then kind of wanted to tie it together. And so they made this episode after kind of understanding and developing the characters, which is why it's such a good introduction to Wirt and Greg, honestly.
Right. So first off, the episode starts with like a nice kind of tune, you know, a slow, calm sort of piano ballad. And it also shows a lot of the upcoming side characters as sort of foreshadowing. And then, you meet Wirt and Greg immediately. And you immediately get this sort of dynamic between them. That it's pretty much, like, Greg is kind of what I would call chaotic childish.
Yeah.
It's that Greg kind of does whatever and speaks a lot in tropes and makes a lot of, like, jokes about, you know, just like very tropey sayings and stuff. And a lot of times he'll do something, but like end the sentence with something you wouldn't expect. But like the idea is that Greg is innocent. He's childish. That's sort of just him having fun. And compare that to Wirt, who is constant anxiety.
Wirt is immediately a character who is always on edge and always like assumes that the exact worst will happen.
Yeah. Worst. That's fun.
Wirt.
In that, like, Wirt is kind of just tolerating Greg at the start of the show in a sort of like, come on, we need to get going sort of way. Very much early Shrek.
Yeah.
That like Wirt is trying to just kind of take Greg home, but doesn't really care much else about what Greg wants at the moment. So they're kind of going, I believe then they meet Beatrice, who offers to show them the way.
Yeah. So, yeah, they're walking down a path and Beatrice is tangled in a bush and she's freed by Greg, who then offers to take them to Adelaide, who she says is the good woman of the woods who can help them on their way home.
And Wirt immediately is like, that's a talking bird, I'm leaving.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, hang on, no, we're mixing this up.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's episode two. Episode one, they just meet Beatrice, they say, that's a talking bird, I'm leaving.
Yeah, then the episode one is more about the woodsman.
Right, after they leave Beatrice, I believe, they see the woodsman, played by Christopher Lloyd, and the woodsman warns them about the beast and offers them a place to stay in this mill. And the woodsman's one of the other like main reoccurring characters that's very central to the story.
Yeah.
They don't believe the woodsman and anything he says about like the beast or anything. They just kind of think he's weird and they try leaving, and then Greg gets attacked by some sort of monster. Like a really mangy looking wolf sort of monster.
Yeah.
They fend off the monster, and by tossing the monster into the river, it turns out it was just a dog. And the dog is friendly. They think they've slayed the beast, But the woodsman says that wasn't the beast. And somehow the brothers are able to get out of there. But so, like, I think what's really interesting, for one thing, is that Wirt blames Greg for literally everything that happens in the episode. So, Wirt's like, we need to knock out this guy so that we can escape from here when the woodsman has them in the mill. And then when Greg is getting chased by the beast, or what they think is the beast, and they're, like, panicking, trying to do something, instead of knocking out the beast, Greg knocks out the woodsman, and he's like, well, you told me to do that, Wirt. And then Greg's leaving a candy trail, kind of like a Hansel and Gretel sort of thing, so that they know where they've been. And then Greg realizes that the beast must have followed the candy trail, and Wirt just says, of course, you led the beast right to us. Like, not even realizing that was just a guess Greg made a second ago. Wirt acts like that was a huge mistake when neither of them could have known.
Yeah.
So, I think that's really interesting, is if you kind of go back through it, everything Wirt shifts the blame. Also, the woodsman has, like, he kind of sets a lot of the themes up. He says that that Greg is the eldest child's responsibility. That, like, basically Wirt should be taking better care of Greg. And that is a pretty constant sort of shadow over the rest of the series. Especially with, like, how at the start Wirt doesn't really want to bother with Greg's antics. And then also, I just want to note that the woodman says... everyone has their lanterns to burn, which is, like, a pretty interesting thematic statement, as I'll talk about later.
Yeah, that ties into the woodsman's character, revealed a bit later. I think something interesting about the woodsman, as he is recurring, is that he is consistently treated pretty terribly by, honestly, both of the kids, but especially Wirt. He is constantly, like, under assumption that he is a villain. He is constantly, like, he is repeatedly kind of taken advantage of by the kids to some extent. Not, like, literally, but in the sense of, like, you know, there's an episode where, like, there's an episode and a part where Wirt kicks the lantern that is in the woodsman's hands out of his hands. And, like, throughout all of it, all the woodsman does is kind of, like, keep warning them and keep trying to keep them from making mistakes. Like, the woodsman is consistently on their sides, even when they are very actively, like, running away from him and actively saying, oh god, it's the bad guy. So it's very interesting.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah, the woodsman is, like, showed to be... I mean, they really play up his, like, sort of manicness. But as it goes on, you realize that he is really just trying to help them. And Wirt's sort of ability to see the worst in people, or, like, to fear people. His fear, that's it. Wirt's fear just gets in the way of all that. And so, yeah, they leave there at the end of episode one. And then in episode two, while they're on the road, that's when they save Beatrice.
Yes.
And Beatrice insists to take them to Adelaide.
Yeah, she's extremely insistent.
Right.
Even as they specifically go against her wishes, they arrive in Pottsfield. Which is a town that just has a bunch of that, like, seemingly is empty, and then they go to a barn and realize that there's a bunch of residents dressed up in pumpkins and straw, and they are, for their transgressions, for disturbing the ceremony that they're doing, and, like, you know, accidentally destroying some pumpkins, they're sentenced to menial labor.
Yeah, they're sentenced to community service, which involves digging holes in a field.
Yeah. And specifically, as they're digging holes in the field, they start to suddenly realize and worry, especially after Greg finds a skeleton, like, oh no, they're going to bury us. But then it ultimately turns out that no, the skeletons are getting out of the holes and joining them for the parade, putting on the pumpkins and such, and that's when Wirt realizes, oh, everybody here is a skeleton.
Right. They even say, like, maybe it's a weird cult early in the episode, and that sort of tension persists throughout it until the very end when they realize they're just digging up dead people to join the other dead people.
Yeah.
This is, like, a pretty common thing the show does in the first half of it, where it'll, like, build up tension and then just resolve it nonchalantly. Not even, like, resolve it in, like, a comedic way necessarily, just, like, a casual way.
Yeah,
like, it's like this weird harvest cult, and they're digging up holes, they think it's their own graves, and then, oh no, it's fine, it's just a skeleton. And the like, leader of the group was even gonna just let him go anyways afterwards.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's not that it's anticlimactic, because it does pay off. It's that the way it pays off is vastly different from the logic of the universe. And the logic of the universe is chaos. It's, you know, honestly, like, very magical realism. But the payoff is always kind of, well, not always, but the payoff is very regularly mundane.
Right.
And this
I was just going to say, this is especially true in the first five episodes.
Yeah. It's so, like, number three, the third episode, because, yeah, like, a lot of the themes kind of continue on. The third episode, Wirt and Beatrice and Greg ultimately happen upon
an old-timey schoolhouse.
Yeah. And Wirt and Beatrice have been having a quarrel, and so Wirt enters the schoolhouse kind of to get back at Beatrice.
Right. Beatrice says that Wirt always does what he's told, that he's a pushover, and so Wirt does everything he's told throughout the episode, which includes going to school, getting in class, getting into the dunce box,
yeah,
going to bed.
And the central tension, of the episode is that there is a gorilla terrorizing people at the school. The teacher of the school, her fiance ran away. The teacher's father is financing the school, but can't make any more money.
Right. Yeah. There's a great moment where, like, when the father first appears at the school, he looks, like, really big in, he's drawn really high, like, tall, pretty much. Like, he looks like somebody who's extremely rich and angry. And then he leaves, and he's like this tiny guy, and he has to make a tent out of his coat. And when it's revealed he's not rich at all. He spent his life savings on the school.
And it's ultimately resolved when the father is going to sell a bunch of instruments that are at the school. And so instead, Greg comes up with the idea to have a school, like, fundraising event where the animals that are in the school, there are animals in the school.
It's a school for animals, by the way. There's a really cute dog that dances a little bit, and it's a very good scene. There's also a possum named Jeffrey. I just wanted to point that out.
And, like, it also should be mentioned, like, there's a lot of talking animals. These are not talking animals, but they are animals who are, like, halfway anthropomorphic.
Right. They, like, they are, especially the ones that Greg hangs out with, which are, like, the truant kids. Like, those act pretty humanly as far as, like, they use tools, they're smart, you know, stuff like that. And what's really funny to me is, so we mentioned the instruments, but what happens is they eat potatoes, and Greg is like, this is bland, I'm gonna pour some molasses on it. He starts singing a song, then gradually as it goes, all the animals start playing instruments, which don't really come from anywhere, but then the instruments are, like, a central point to the episode. Like, it's very seemingly disconnected at first, and then it's like, wait, do they have those instruments there the whole time? It feels non sequitur, and then it becomes sequitur. Is that it?
Sequential.
Sequital?
It's really interesting as well, just because so many of the episodes are like high magical realism that ultimately kind of gets resolved with mundanity. And that's sort of the perfect example where, you know, a one-off gag where like a song turns into people actually singing, turns into the animals playing music with instruments, ultimately ends up mattering a lot towards the conclusion, which is mundane.
Oh, also, speaking of mundane conclusions, the gorilla appears at the benefit concert, and I think it's just like the father says do something, and Wart runs over and tackles the gorilla. No, he trips on his shoelace.
Yeah, shoelace is a Chekhov's gun placed at the very beginning where he keeps stopping to tie it, and Beatrice is like, Bort, come on.
Yeah, and then so he trips over his shoelace, tackles the gorilla. It turns out the teacher's husband was stuck in the gorilla costume after he got a job at the circus to pay for their wedding ring. And he was stuck in the costume, and that's why he kept trying to chase people, because nobody would help him out, because they were too scared of him. So, like, also, the gorilla is a completely mundane Scooby-Doo sort of thing. But also, like, the guy still loves the teacher, and they still get along together at the end. So it's, like, it's another sort of non-climax that is a climax, but also is kind of settled cleanly.
Also, it should be noted as well, I believe this is on the IMDb page, but in the actual song that is sung by the teacher, apparently her fiance ran away after 3 days and has been, oh, sorry, he's been missing for 3 days, but it feels like 8. So, you know, again, it's the reality isn't really what matters. It's the feeling of it and how it flows.
Right.
Sort of within the unknown.
Right. Episode 4, I think, is where we start really getting into Wirt as a character, like, more so than him being just kind of a stick in the mud that's really afraid of things. So, episode 4, they come to a tavern on, like, a rainy night, and they stop inside, and inside the tavern is a lot of people who are pretty much just known for their jobs. You know, there's the butcher, the baker, the midwife, the tailor, the cobbler, the tavern keeper. And they introduce themselves as such. And then there's the highwayman.
Yeah, the highwayman who sings a just wonderful song.
It has some incredible animation, too. It's like almost like a fisheye lens effect. He gets like really close to the camera and it's at kind of an up-angled shot. He does this all wavy dance. It's really impressive.
Yeah.
Also, I like that the highwayman isn't introduced by the tavern keeper, but interrupts the conversation they have with Wirt just to sing. So the people in the tavern ask Wirt who he is, and Wirt's like, I'm Wirt, this is my brother Greg, and they're like, no, what are you? Like, who are you? Like, they're looking for a job or a role or something. Wirt says he just wants to be himself, but he doesn't really say what that means.
And when he starts like trying to just ask, I'm trying to find a woman named Adelaide, they misinterpret that and say, oh, you're the lovebird. And so they start singing about, you know, how everybody has a job when it's the lovebird's wedding day.
Oh yeah. It's that it starts with just like trying to help Wirt look good. But then the person singing talks about how like everybody's going to get paid when it's the lovebird's wedding day. Like, they care more about having a job to do than helping him.
Yeah.
Which, I guess everybody needs money to, you know, help live. But the thing is that, like, it's interesting to me because they're really desperately trying to put a label on Wirt. And Wirt doesn't want to, like, take a label. But he doesn't also know what to call himself.
Yeah. It's a very interesting, I'm going to say very interesting a lot. You're Let's try that again. It's a wonderful dynamic between Wirt and the townstead itself, because the townstead itself is built upon labels. And, oh god, I'm just about to say exactly what you are again. No, I'm not. The town itself is built upon labels, but it's built to be its own self-sustaining machine. And so when Wirt and Greg come in, and also, you know, it is notable that they don't question Greg.
Yeah.
Greg is fine. Greg makes sense. Beatrice gets chased out of the tavern, which is a B-plot, effectively, that involves the woodsman afterwards. But, like, Wirt comes there asking something, and so because Wirt is trying to actively, like, establish himself with them, they have to have a role for him to fit.
Yeah, and it's because he wants to interact with them.
And it's interesting then that, like, once he clarifies, they kind of ascribe him a non-role. They say, oh, that makes more sense. You're a pilgrim. And it's a role, but it's kind of not, because they specifically say that, you know, you're the pilgrim. You come and you go, and, you know, whatever, your road is your own. And that's when Wirt kind of goes, actually, I like that label. Right. Actually, I think that works with me.
What's interesting to me is that the pilgrim describes, like, the sacred journey is what they say. But the journey isn't something that Wirt did to himself. It's sort of incidental. He's thrust into this role of having to find their way home. So, like, he's still getting a label that he didn't really form for himself. And it doesn't describe him, it just describes the situation he's put under without his sort of control. Also, Fred, the talking horse, appears in this episode. And the first word he says is, "Nice to horse your acquaintance." I just need that to be said.
The fun thing about the show is that, like, it is probably, I'd say, 80%, 70% just kind of, you know, very serious, very, like, telling a story. But there's the 30% of levity where it's just really funny. It's also, I have to say, like, the kind of show that could only be told with animation. That's right. Something that's really important, is that, like, not just all the gags and the talking animal characters, it's so much of the presentation kind of just has to be animation for it to work, with the, like you said, the Highwayman sort of weird warbling, like, fisheye lens effect when he starts singing, all of the pumpkin people in the town. And, like, it is only heightened by the fact that it's not told in another way. It right. is told through a visual medium that allows this, and not with real people, not with CGI.
Right. The B plot, really quick, is that Beatrice pretty much hears something going on in the woods. And, like, it's kind of jumped back and forth. She interacts with Fred a bit. And then as Wirt and Greg are in the tavern, and Wirt's, like, being hoisted up as a pilgrim, they hear, like, a shriek or a scream coming from the woods, and they go out to chase after that because it turns out Beatrice was missing. So they take Fred, they go on a horse ride, and it looks like the woodsman is about to kill Beatrice. And so they save Beatrice, they kick over the woodsman's lantern, it lights a tree on fire, and then they kind of just get out of there.
Yeah.
So yeah. Episode 5 is pretty funny to me. Just because it constantly reminds me of House of Leaves. I like that the expanding house is just a trope now. So first off, this is probably, I think, to me, the funniest episode because of the premise behind it. Is they're going to, it's like a tea baron. You know, a guy that's really rich off selling tea, but he's also old and kind of senile. And so Greg and Wirt are pretending to be his nephews, I think, in order to get money from him, because they need money to ride the ferry to Adelaide. You know, this is all just like, just anyways. But so
it's part of the dream logic where it's like, you understand it because it all comes within its own context, basically. Right.
So For one thing that's great is Fred says that he wants to steal, and so he and Beatrice try to steal money from the old man, Endicott, Quincy Endicott, as I think his name. Meanwhile, the old man is taking Greg and the frog on a tour of his house, explaining how he started to find hallways he didn't remember building, and he saw a ghost of a woman he had never... he saw a picture of a woman he'd never seen before, and then he thought he saw a ghost of that woman that same night. And so he and Greg are trying to find the ghost.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Fred joins back up with them, and Beatrice and Wirt get locked in a cabinet. While they're locked in the cabinet, Wirt and Beatrice talk. They're forced to kind of interact with each other. And this is, like, the first time Wirt talks about himself, like, what he's interested in, what his hobbies are. It turns out he likes poetry and clarinet, and he has studied architecture at some point.
Yeah, there's a really good joke. Really good joke made afterwards where they leave, they find a way out of the cupboard through the back wall and into an entirely new section of the house, and Wirt looks up and he's like, hang on, this French Baroque style doesn't mesh well with
the like Gothic style of Endicott's manor.
Yeah.
And
it's such a good joke.
What I like about this is that so this actually gets Wirt to realize what's going on, that the ghost that Endicott saw was actually a real person who also had a giant manor, and the manors were growing so big from them just adding extensions onto it that they eventually ran into each other's houses. I don't know how you let that happen, but it's such like, again, it's another like nonchalant way of resolving the growing house trope.
Yeah.
But like, also I think it's really interesting because this is the first time where Wirt like actively resolves the conflict. And he does it by something he's interested in, which is architecture. Like, even though Beatrice kind of makes fun of him for it. His knowledge actually kind of helps him realize the problem, and then he saves the day.
It also is at this point that it's revealed that Beatrice's main backstory is that she threw a rock at a bluebird, and the bluebird cursed her and her family to become bluebirds. But the conflict she is having personally is she's obviously trying to find the thing to turn her back into a human. But specifically, the conflict is that she doesn't want to tell her family that she is the reason they're bluebirds, that they are all bluebirds.
Right. Yeah. There's sort of like this idea of like responsibility going on. Just like how the problem that Greg is in is Wirt's responsibility. The problem, or not problem, but like them being lost is Wirt's responsibility. Beatrice's family being bluebirds is her responsibility. And how they kind of try to fix that is what's in conflict. But I think that's most of it for episode 5. There is a Xanadu peacock. It's even black and white. I just think that's a clever touch. Peacocks are a sign of luxury and excess, as per Citizen Kane. And then also, I mean, they leave Fred, but then they get the 2 cents that they need to ride the ferry, and Greg immediately throws it into a pond, which just sets the conflict for the next episode.
Yeah.
So episode 6 is they are on like a steamboat filled with frogs and clothes, and they snuck on board. They weren't able to pay the ferry toll because Greg threw 2 pennies in the fountain, and also Greg's frog is naked, and so the frog police want to arrest him, and also they want to arrest Wirt because they snuck on. It's kind of unclear exactly why they're upset. Also another thing that happens is there's like a band on the boat, and they accidentally knock out the bassoon player. And so, in the midst of this, like, all the frogs are extremely upset, kind of just losing their minds over there being no bassoon for the band. And Greg plays the bassoon, not Greg, Wirt plays the bassoon with some sort of convincing by Beatrice, and it actually works perfectly. And he's actually, like, proud of how well he played the bassoon.
And it's at this point that the frog actually begins to sing. For the first time, technically the second time, like, the first time in universe, because the frog actually is the one who is singing the opening song of the first episode. Right. But, like, it's the only time that in the canon itself, the frog is singing. Right. And the, like, I believe that he is singing at least something very close to the opening song.
I think this is another case of, well, what's interesting about this is not only does Wirt save the day by, you know, doing something he likes and, like, being confident in himself, but he also, this is the first time he does, like, the hard thing. You know, previously he kind of tried to do the easy way out for, I mean, a few things at least. Whether that be blame somebody or, like, kind of just follow what he's told at the schoolhouse. In the end, he does the hard thing only when, like, threatened directly, or when Greg is threatened, or Beatrice, I guess, also. When somebody he likes is threatened, he does the hard thing. But this time is, like, the first time he outright just does it without somebody's life literally being on the line.
Okay.
Yeah,
we should speed run the explanation of these a little bit because I really want to get into the themes a lot.
Yes. So after that, they leave the boat. They're walking around a bit. They go to Adelaide, and it turns out Adelaide is like a witch and was wanting to capture Wirt and Greg and make them her servants. And that Beatrice was doing this because Adelaide held a magical scissors that could turn Beatrice and her family back to humans. Wirt and Greg are able to escape, and Wirt is extremely depressed for the rest of the series because, like, the one person who helped him be comfortable with himself betrayed him in the end. The next episode, they go to a house in the woods where they meet a girl named Lorna, who is taking care of a lady named Auntie Whispers, who is very Yubaba from Spirited Away.
Yeah, she's extremely, like, always doing your chores, always to be working.
Oh, I also mean in visual design.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
She's like very large-faced old lady. Her face is like 70% of her body, and the rest, you know, big old crone nose. She's the archetypal old crone, but she's not she isn't Yubaba from Spirited Away. The secret is that she's the other one from Spirited Away, though.
Yeah. So the Auntie Whispers uses a bell to, like, command Lorna to do chores and stuff, and everybody thinks that Auntie Whispers eats kids, but it turns out Lorna eats kids because she's possessed by an evil spirit, unless she's commanded by the bell to do something. And so when Wirt thinks he's saving Lorna from, like, an abusive, like, slavery sort of situation, Wirt actually sees that Lorna is going to eat him. Luckily, Wirt thinks to use the bell to just exorcise the spirit, which works.
Which is another part of the through line of Wirt actually sort of solving the problem kind of on his own volition. In this case, it is a little bit under duress because he is being chased by that spirit, but, like, he uses his general reasoning to go, well, hang on, if I can command the spirit with the bell, it's not just commanding Lorna, it's commanding the spirit, so I can just tell the spirit, hey, don't eat kids, get out of Lorna, go away forever.
Yeah.
For
most of the series before episode 6, I think it is, the one with the boat, episode 5. Before episode 5, the one with the mansion, Wirt kind of turns to other people to make decisions and, like, to tell him what to do. But this one, he outright says, like, I'm going to save you, I want to help you. And then he ends up, like you said, making the decision. But even before that, when he enters the house, he's the one who says, I need to do the hard thing to help you.
Yeah. It is also sort of worth commenting upon that, like, once the demon leaves, Auntie is sad because she believes that Lorna basically has no use for her. And Lorna says, oh, I would never leave you. And it certainly suggests that, like, while Auntie Whispers was ultimately actually doing it for Lorna's benefit, it kind of suggests that, like, she possibly knew she could have just gotten rid of the spirit, but she was just sort of preying upon the fact that the spirit was there so that out of fear that Lorna would leave her. And so, like, it ties into a much bigger and much more persistent theme throughout the entire series that we'll get to after we're done with sort of the recap. But yeah, it's interesting to consider, basically.
Yeah. Episode 8 is the weirdest episode. It's the fever dream episode where Greg has a dream where he goes to Cloud City. There's this really weird committee number 4. I hate it.
Yeah. So the brothers are traveling around the woods. I believe they're traveling down a lake at the start, but then they're traveling through the woods and Mort kind of just literally gives up. He just literally says, like, whatever, Greg, you're in charge. I've been messing everything up. I'm just going to sit here and nap. And so Greg falls asleep ultimately, and then has that dream that's very 1930s animation. It's everything has a face. Everything is bouncy. He gets greeted by multiple committees, like you said, in a very, like, Wizard of Oz way, where there's the greeting committee, and then there's
the auxiliary committee.
Yeah, the auxiliary greeting committee, and then
there's just the committee number 3, and then Greg's just like, is there anything else? And then there's a weird, like, creepy moment.
Yeah, there's like a dog staring creepily with a rain cloud, and Greg's just like, okay, that's enough.
Yeah, and there's like this creepy music box, like Jack in the Box sort of rolling sound. I don't know how to put it. Anyways, yeah, it goes on for a bit. It kind of just happens. There's the North Wind attacks and starts trying to blow down everybody's houses. And Greg just kind of runs away from the North Wind for a bit. Then he captures the North Wind in a bottle. And the, like, princess queen of Cloud City, I don't remember the exact honorific, says that she'll grant Greg a wish for helping them. Greg is afraid that, like, since Wirt can't go on for himself, Greg needs to be the leader now. And so Greg's like, I need to help Wirt. What's one thing I can do? And somehow he gets the idea to go visit the Beast. Cue episode 9.
Which is, of course, the prequel to the entire series.
Right. This is the big reveal where we see how everything started. It turns out, spoiler alert for Over the Garden Wall, in case you haven't watched it yet. It turns out, so it all started on Halloween when Greg was leaving a house of a lady where he had to rake leaves to get candy. There's also a great line where he says, thank you, old lady. And the lady says, please don't call me old lady. And then Greg says, yes, sir, young man. Just like great wordplay there. Wirt made a mixtape to confess to a crush he had. Confess to a crush he had. But Wirt is unable to overcome his anxiety to actually deliver the mixtape. So Greg, like, takes the mixtape over to the Wirt's crush's friends, who kind of put it in her pocket, like her jacket pocket or whatever.
Yeah.
And then Wirt's like, we got to get that tape back. I can't let her hear it. And so Greg actually helps Wirt get the tape. They, like, go to a house party, and Wirt's really afraid at first, but it turns out everybody's fine with him being there. Wirt's crush invites him to go to the graveyard with, like, this friend group. And Wirt says he doesn't want to at first, and then he regrets it. And then he and Greg kind of stumble their way through the graveyard. A cop car appears, which was a joke earlier in the episode, saying, like, hey, you, don't run in the streets. Nah, just kidding. Happy Halloween. And it tells them to, like, what are you kids doing in this graveyard? And then as the kids all run out, because, you know, the cops are there, the cop's like, wait, I was just kidding. They climb up on a graveyard wall. They fall backwards out off of it, but they're kind of safe. They land in a bush.
Well, the specifically, like, they don't fall off, because part of the tension is that Wirt's crush is going to be confessed to by
Jason Funderburger, just another kid.
And what Wirt is just like, I think Wirt mentions him before and is like, I can't compete with that kid. And then when Jason Funderburger is revealed, his voice is literally the like, hi, I'm a pathetic character voice.
He's somewhere between pathetic and average.
Yeah.
And so, also, it's worth noting that, like, Jason makes advances on Sarah, the crush, the whole time, and Sarah's like, no, don't get your hand on me like that.
Yeah. But he sees them together, and so Wirt assumes, oh god, he's confessed, and I can't compete. So he just jumps off to the other side.
Well, specifically, it's that Sarah finally sees the mixtape in her jacket pocket, and Jason goes, let's listen to it. And Wirt is afraid that they'll make fun of the tape, which has clarinet and poetry on it.
Right.
So, Wirt jumps off the other side with Greg. They're kind of messing around. Wirt is really mad at Greg because he thinks Greg ruined it between giving the other girls the mixtape and giving away their position in the graveyard so he couldn't sneak around and take the tape back.
It's also at that point he blows up on Greg, not just for that, but like he says, you know, Greg is kind of responsible for everything, but he also specifically mentions that like he kind of hates Greg because Greg is his father's his stepdad's son. And he is his mother's son. And, you know, they apparently have recently just gotten together. Which is explained earlier.
That's like explained in episode 3. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like when he blows up, he clearly isn't blowing up specifically at Greg or just at his actions. But like, it's definitely like he's taking it out on Greg because of his anxiety about the whole situation with his mother and his stepdad. But it's ultimately interrupted when a train is shown to be running towards them, and they
bail out, they fail out, they fall out, then they fall into a river or a lake or a pond or something like that, spillway, and then it cuts back to Wirt waking up in the woods. This sets up sort of this explains the tension from the start of the show. It explains like why Wirt was more capable after episode 5, where he talks about himself that like he wants to like that he does poetry and clarinet. He's just afraid that other people will make fun of him for it. Yeah. And that like that's why it's such a big deal why he played the bassoon in front of all those frogs, is that people actually liked it. Also, something interesting is that, not only is the frog and the rock that Greg has, not only do those appear in the flashback, but so does, on one of the gravestones is the name Quincy Endicott. So, like, there's these little notes to sort of the characters that appeared in Over the Garden Wall.
Yeah. It is... no small amount hinted, and like I honestly don't even think it's subtext. It's kind of effectively text that like the unknown is kind of a purgatory state. It is at the very least like a world that is on the border between life and death, because death is super constantly like a big motif throughout the entire unknown. From literally the first and second episodes where you know the woodsman is trying to keep his daughter alive in the lamp, and the entire town is dead people, and the like big head pumpkin guy literally says like, you know, it's fine if you don't want to stay, you'll be joining us soon.
Yeah, I also I could get into it a bit. I just want to quickly go over episode 10, the final episode, which is where Wirt wakes up after he realizes Greg is gone. He goes to run after Greg, falls into a pool of ice, gets rescued by Beatrice, and from there he goes to find Greg again, now making amends with Beatrice. They find Greg, he's like covered in vines and roots and stuff, And it turns out that the Edelwood trees are all like people who died and got lost in the woods. The woodsman is like, he realizes that he's been chopping down dead people's remains and says that he doesn't want to keep the lantern lit, even if his daughter's soul is inside it.
So, the beast, the beast at that point, then like once Wurt is trying to keep his brother alive, the beast, offers effectively the same deal where he's like, I'll keep your brother alive in that lantern, but you will have to go stalk the woods and light it up. And Wurt says yes, starts walking towards the beast, and then says, wait, no, that makes no sense. Like, that's stupid. There's no way you would care about a dumb lamp that much. It's like this lamp holds your soul.
And the beast says, like, no, why would that be? Basically, yeah, Wurt cracked the code, and he threatens multiple times to blow out the lantern.
Which causes the beast to get very frantic, and Wurt then kind of, you know, effectively having shown the game, gives the lantern back to the woodsman and is like, here, you know, this is yours, but I'm gonna go home with my brother.
Yeah. So they're able to make it out alive. There's a scene after they leave where the woodsman shines the light on the beast itself, and the beast is like this weird demon with a bunch of faces on it. It's really gross. It's only for like a split second.
Yeah.
Like 10 frames. And then the woodsman ultimately blows out the lantern, content that this is the right thing to do. Then there's a montage where Greg and Wurt are in the lake. They kind of get out alive. They are in the ambulance, and then they wake up, and then Wurt wakes up in the hospital. Greg is fine. Wurt's fine. His friends from school, or at least the people that were at the graveyard, are there to make sure they're okay. And Sarah is the first person to wake Wurt up. And what I really like is that Sarah's like, I don't have a tape player. And like, before she can finish, Wurt says, we can listen to it at my house. So it's not, it's like Wurt had become more assertive over the course of the show. He had sort of like learned to be comfortable with himself, because in episode 9 in the flashback, he was more worried about people making fun of him, like playing clarinet and doing poetry, than he was about rejection outright. He was worried that people would make fun of him. So not only is he like, he's assertive in that he actually talks to Sarah and says like, yeah, let's hang out. He also is okay with her hearing it. And then there's like a little montage of all the people we've seen and all of the sort of plots that have been resolved. It goes backwards through the series. So like, the next one we see after the after that bit is Lorna, and then it's like the frogs, and then it keeps going back until it reaches the woodsman, where it turns out his daughter was alive, just kind of in a cabin, and the woodsman was nowhere near. And then it shows Beatrice's family back to humans, and then finally Greg puts the rock back in the garden, because it turns out he had stolen the rock from the old lady.
Yeah.
Okay, so...
Themes.
Wurt looks like a gnome. I just want to say that. I forgot to say that. He looks like a gnome. Okay.
Well, I love that in episode 9, he grabs, like, a union jacket and a Santa hat, and literally it's asked, like, are you a gnome? And he's like, I don't know, whatever. I'm just trying to find Sarah.
Yeah. Very half-assed the costume, which is what I do. So yeah, Wurt is like incredibly anxious over every decision, but you know, he wants to be like, it's like he knows what he likes. He's just afraid of other people rejecting him and like making fun of him and stuff like that. And so I think that's why he's like so distrustful until the point where he starts talking about his interests. And then, like I said, when Beatrice betrays him, it's not just that a person he thought was a friend betrayed him, but the person who made him comfortable with liking the things he likes betrayed him. Because that sort of validation was what he was looking for.
Yeah, and it's also kind of interesting that, like, in episode 9 we get the key in that part of it is that his mother has remarried or gotten together or whatever. But, like, far as I can tell, there aren't really allusions to, like, a neglectful stepdad or even a neglectful mother. It's not like a, you know, the family that has raised you is neglectful, but you need to learn to love yourself. There's his mother and father are beyond that, kind of a non-factor. Yeah. It really is just sort of like Wirt's own personal journey where he needs to learn that what he likes, what he is cool with are valid. You know, what he wants to be is ultimately a good thing because he wants to be it.
Right. I don't think it's a mistake that that they rarely ever interact with somebody their age. The only person really that they do so is Lorna, if you don't count Beatrice. Every main conflict involves a, like, authority figure or a parental figure. So, like, there's the woodsman, there's the person who's the leader of the Pottsfield Chamber of Commerce. There's all the people in the tavern. There is, you know, the Endicott. There's the police on the frog boat and so forth. Whereas Greg's conflict is something more cartoony. The Cloud City episode literally has, like, a vignetting going on around it, like you're looking through a telescope. Wirt's conflicts are all about things that he's seen and is kind of either afraid of or has something to do with just, like, parents or people who kind of look after you.
It's because of that that I think it's really interesting that he solves it. He solves a lot of the problems by just kind of being sort of adult. He solves, even like up to the very last problem, he ultimately solves it by just sort of being rational and sort of actually thinking things through. And it gets him through. There is no moment where, like, he has to let his mind go to Greg. You know, Greg does, like, not that learning to like Greg isn't a big part of it, because learning to like his brother and learning to take responsibility for his brother is certainly, like, a very recurring and very big part of the series. But, like, there is no one moment where it's like, oh, Greg's magical thinking is actually the thing that I should be doing, you know.
Right. Even when Wirt even says that, like, Greg is the leader, it's something that's framed as, like, a bad move. You know, the woodsman says, like, that their situation is the eldest responsibility, and a lot of that is, like, Wirt accepting that fact. And it's really that, like, when Wirt becomes confident in himself, he stops trying to blame Greg, because he starts to see how he can fix things his own way. Whereas, like, before that episode, there's a lot of times where Wirt will either ignore Greg or blame Greg outright.
One big recurring theme, I think, is letting an obsession control you, is how I would phrase it. Where, like, within the main characters, Wirt's obsession is obviously, like, his anxieties with being cool, his anxieties over Greg. You know, he wants to distance himself from kind of everybody, effectively. And what sets him free is when he learns to live with what he is. But, like, the theme gets kind of just repeated over and over. The woodsman himself is constantly chopping down trees to make oil for the lamp that holds his daughter. The Lorna's auntie
Whispers.
Auntie Whispers is, like, constantly, you know, keeping Lorna under her thumb for the demon's sake. But, like, you know, her learning to accept that Lorna doesn't have to be with her is part of Lorna being exorcised. The entire Quincy Endicott scandal is, you know, his obsession over wealth has built this expanding house that he does not recognize and led him to a love in a painting that he cannot find and cannot bear to face. And like, it's really interesting, I think, because if we take a purgatorial reading of the actual unknown, it's really interesting because it ties into, like, you know, earthly things keeping you from achieving nirvana in a sort of sense. But that's also not necessarily a bad thing. So, like, for example, the woodsman is ultimately proven to be in the wrong. You know, the woodsman is ultimately proven, like, it ultimately is figured out that he is actually chopping down live people. Not necessarily live, but he is chopping down people for a lantern that isn't even his daughter. And learning to let go is what helps him ultimately to find his daughter again. But you have a case like Greg, where in episode 8, I would kind of honestly personally read Greg's like dream world as sort of him possibly dying and going to heaven. Because like, as the two are sleeping, they're growing colder and it's kind of clear that like the snow probably will kill them in a realistic sense. But like when he solves the problem, he ascends to, you know, the princesses or whatever, the queen of the clouds. He ascends to her level and she grants him a wish, but she says, oh, but you can't take, you know, you can't take Wurt with you. Wurt can't come with. And Greg ultimately says, well, no, because I want to help Wurt. You know?
Yeah.
It's interesting because a lot of it is about letting go, but a lot of it is also about staying where you are, you know?
I have a bit on this. So the woodsman says everyone has their lanterns to burn. And at first it's like the lantern is a guiding thing. And you think like, oh, the lantern is like something that's important to you. But to me, yeah, the lantern is also like that sort of attachment to something in the past, like not letting go. The woodsman's reason for burning the lantern is his daughter. And when the woodsman loses the lantern and Wurt picks it up, and sort of the ending of the 10th episode, at first Wurt is given the option to just roam the woods forever, which is kind of what he wanted. He kind of, for a moment, didn't want to return to normal life. But then Wurt, instead of clinging to like the past and worrying about how Sarah was gonna listen to the mixtape or how she might have been confessed to or whatever, he loses the lantern because he moves on from that sort of worry. And then the woodsman blows out the lantern because he's also ready to move on finally. And I think like a lot of characters in Over the Garden Wall are kind of attached to something that keeps them stagnated, I guess.
Yeah.
Like the tavern people are attached to their jobs, even though nobody seems to need them. The Auntie Whispers is attached to Lorna, even though Auntie Whispers knows that she could exercise the spirit completely. But like none of these people want to change and grow. And to me, that's part of what the unknown is it's just the future. It's maturing, it's changing, it's being a better person. Because all the people that are stuck there have kind of their own problems, I guess. But especially the people who are lost in the woods are the people who are the most obsessed with the past in some way. So like the woodsman is, you know, kind of doomed to wander the woods chopping down these trees because he is super obsessed with whatever happened to his daughter. And he is so obsessed with it that he's, you know, going through these very long lengths. And then, of course, Wurt is obsessed with sort of the whole night that led up to them being lost, that he gets lost in the woods. Yeah, and then, like, everybody who gets lost turns into trees. I think that's outright said. And so, like, Wurt starts to get branches growing around him when he's sleeping, and Greg goes to Cloud City. And it's kind of implied that Greg's wish saves Wurt from that fate, but then it ends up putting Greg into like the hands of the beast, who then puts him in vines. And to me, that was sort of like, to me, that was like Greg losing his innocence in a way. But also it is like Greg is worried about Wurt, but he also isn't letting Wurt grow, I guess. I don't know if that makes sense. Basically, the trees are people who got so lost that they couldn't move, which is almost Wurt at a point. He gets so depressed that he doesn't want to get up off of the ground. And so the people who wander the woods are also people who don't want to move, or are people that, like, find themselves stuck even if they don't realize it.
Yeah, I think Greg's role is effectively that Greg wants to help Wurt. Greg does help Wurt, but it kind of ties into the responsibility angle where, like, Greg attempts to help Wurt desperately by going to the beast and ultimately, like, almost becoming a tree. It's like Greg wants to help Wurt, but, like, he's kind of unable to because Wurt is the one who should be looking out for Greg.
Yeah. Yeah, to me it feels like the beast is, I mean, it's essentially a devil figure, but, like, specifically that the beast wants people to be at their lowest, and the beast realizes that if he takes Greg away, then Wurt will be at his lowest, which almost happens.
Yeah.
Yeah, also, just with the title, to me it feels like the garden wall is, like, safety. It's kind of just, like, it's kind of like the graveyard wall in the episode 9, so maybe purgatory is pretty apt, but to me it's like the garden is like friendly and familiar, but then going into the unknown is going over the garden wall to where it's like spooky and mysterious. But it's like, in that regard, it's kind of a coming of age sort of thing. Like, you can't predict what the future is going to hold, and not everybody's out to get you. And not everybody has answers for you to find your way through, sort of thing.
I find it interesting with episodes 9 and 10, where episode 9 is Into the Unknown and episode 10 is The Unknown, where the area itself is the unknown, but the only times that the unknown are explicitly stated are episode 9, where they go into the unknown. But episode 10 is when they come back to the real world. And so, yeah. I think that supports a lot the idea that the unknown is the future and change, because, like, the unknown is a physical place in this world, but, like, them going into the unknown and them coming back from the unknown is them accepting that there's going to be things happening in the future that they're just going to have to, you know, like, they will have to become the kind of person who can deal with it, at least Wurt specifically. Greg,
I don't even think we mentioned this, but so Greg thinks that the entire reason they got lost was his fault, because he stole that rock from the old lady's yard when he was doing yard work. He thinks that, like, they were cursed and punished because Greg did that. And so, like, it kind of dawns on you, like, wait, Wurt blaming Greg for everything did actually kind of affect Greg negatively. And that Greg's, yeah, internalizing all that blame. And so the garden wall is also sort of like Greg leaves the garden wall by taking the rock and leaving the old lady's garden. And that makes Greg so, like, afraid of his problems and afraid of that. And he feels so much blame on him. And at the end, when they go into the unknown, and, you know, at the end of the series, he puts the rock back, which both is one of the last things you see of them, but also it's like him moving on. He no longer wants this rock, and he's also absolved of his guilt. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I find it a little, it's interesting to kind of ask the question of, like, what in the unknown is real and what is allegory, where, like, in the fiction of the show. So, like, for example, The Woodsman, I honestly always kind of saw that as, like, him dying, like, his soul moving on and his daughter being alive is him kind of, like, moving on to heaven, where, like, he's trapped in this purgatorial state of always constantly trying to get oil for the lantern to save his daughter, but when he finally accepts that his daughter is dead is when he finally is able to see her again.
It's interesting. To me, I feel like it's the opposite, that his daughter was always alive, in that the woodsman was in this purgatory because he had thought he had lost her. Because, like, in the end of the show, they pretty much go from being in the river after the train almost hits them to leaving the river. So wherever they were, it wasn't, they weren't, like, they didn't walk there.
Yeah. You know,
they were either teleported there or they were, like, whisked away supernaturally in sort of a purgatory sense. And I can buy that, but I also don't necessarily know if I buy that the woodman died. I don't know. To me, it always personally seemed like he was also in this, but he just left to the real world. But it could be me. I was going to say, I do have one more, like, main thematic point.
Yeah.
So this is sort of an anti-Grimm's fairy tale. You know, there's the idea in pretty much all the old Grimm fairy tales that's like, the woods is dangerous, don't go there. There's people that will eat you, and there's monsters that will eat you, wolves that will eat you, just don't go in the woods. But over the garden wall, the whole idea is that, like, people will get lost in the woods, and that's, like, used as a metaphor of, like, not really knowing who you are or what your purpose is, or being clinging to the past. So it takes this, like, metaphorical approach to being lost in the woods. But, like, at the same time, it's not that there are monsters in the woods, it's that there are people just like you who also kind of have their own things to deal with. They have their own problems in the past they're clinging on to. You know, the person who's also lost, who seems like he's going to kill them, the woodsman, has pretty much his own version of what Wirt is going through. And it's sort of showing that, like, you know, not only is, like, you know, don't get lost in the woods, but also it's not super scary. There might not be monsters. There's a lot of people that are in the same position as you.
Yeah.
Also, Grim Tales just end in death, and this one specifically does not end in death. It ends in resuscitation.
Yeah. It's a world of death that is constantly, ultimately bright. It's a world that is, like, entrenched deeply in the ideas of death, but, like, everything, like, pretty much everything has a more or less positive ending. There are, like, two characters who don't, and they don't deserve it, them being the Beast and somebody trying to, you know, kidnap kids for the Beast. So, like, it's also an anti-Grimm's fairy tale in that sense, where, like, you know, Grimm's fairy tales are notoriously the, like, fairy tales that would start off plain and then end in gruesome, terrible ways to teach your kids a lesson. But in this specific instance, it's teaching kids a lesson by kind of, like, trivializing and normalizing a lot of the spookier aspects of fairy tale or fantasy.
Yeah. Especially horror tropes like the cultist town or the expanding house, you know, those are and the possessed child.
Yeah,
those all are given resolutions and happy endings.
Yeah. I'd say, unless you have any closing thoughts, that would be a good, you know, bow to put on the episode.
Again, I think it's interesting that this is, like, a really popular show as far as, like, fandoms go, I guess. But at the same time, I completely get it. It has so much packed into a 10-episode series. Like, it has so much consistency and cohesion, and Elijah Wood plays Wirt, and he has voice cracks a few times, and I don't know if that was planned or not. It's very good.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you, like, aren't sure, if you're interested in it, it's very short. It's a quick watch. It's a good time. It's perfect for November.
It's 2 hours long, and even with us describing the entire thing, it's certainly something that you just have to experience for yourself. The second episode is one of my favorite pieces of animation, probably. The second episode.
I was going to say the third might be, for me.
Like, I love all of it, but, like, there's so much in the second episode to love for me. But, like, yeah, it's a very, very good series that is lived on past, like, far past it kind of would normally, mostly due to the kind of internet contained nature of it.
Right. It's also just that good.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a wonderful Halloween or fall watch.
Fall watch tonight fall at 10 watch. On NBC.
All right.
Thank you for listening. You can follow me on Twitter at Matt Craig Gaming.
And you can follow me on Twitter at Galen Wilson. The Wilson has a zero. You can figure out where it is.
Yeah. I wonder. Ooh. See ya.
Thank you very much for listening.